supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
If the guy with the delusion knows it's a delusion, then it's not a delusion.
Yes, yes, this is not an episode about diets or politics. From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY to bring you true personal stories that speak to the pressing issues of our time. I'm your host, Jamie Brunson. Please call me Jamie J. And I'm here in the studio with
Elizabeth Perez Luna of WHYY.
So today we're talking about mental health with stories, interviews, and media. I think we get most of our enduring images about people with mental health issues from TV and film, and it can be pretty confusing.
Here are a few examples.
I'm not going to take any meds. I should just tell you that right now.
No, you have to take medicines.
No, I'm not going to take any meds. No, look, it makes me foggy.
No, you will have to take medication.
I don't want to need meds, doctor. I'm sorry. Look, I am not the explosion guy, okay?
There they were. Hundreds of the cutest little fat people floating right in front of me. It was wonderful. And then they spoke. I said, whoa!
You know, there are too many buttons in the world. There's way too many just begging to be pressed.
Why doesn't anybody ever press mine? Why am I so neglected? Why doesn't anybody reach in and rip out the truth and tell me that I'm a whore or that my parents wish I were dead? Because you're dead already, Lisa!
Here's Johnny!
We also hear about behavioral health issues in the headlines, when it may be too late and something tragic has happened.
But the truth is much simpler and at the same time even more complicated. Studies say that 1 out of 4 people suffer from some sort of behavioral health issue, and most are more likely to be victims of crimes than the perpetrators. Of course, that doesn't make tragedy when it happens any easier to bear.
So we thought we'd hear from real people living with behavioral health issues to understand them a little better. We have stories from brave folks today who are willing to share their experiences with us. But first, let me introduce the third person in the studio. He's Dr. Lawrence Real, the Chief Medical Officer of the City of Philadelphia Department of Behavioral Health and Intellectual Disability Services. Welcome, Dr. Real.
Thank you, Jamie. I'm happy to be here.
So we have some stories, and some of them are funny. And, you know, is it okay to laugh about these behavioral health issues? Is that all right?
Well, that's interesting you ask that, because one of the things that struck me listening to several of the stories was the importance of humor and how these people were able to reflect their lived experience with a certain amount of humor, which, again, is a way to join with the rest of us. And I think humor is amongst the best medicine that we have. And the ability to laugh at oneself is important. And I think, no, we don't want to laugh at people. We certainly can laugh with them.
Why don't we start with Justine?
So this is a story about my interview at Google. So I was living in Austin, Texas at the time. I was working for a mutual fund company, and at the time I had a lot of free time. And so in my free time, I started developing this social network. Just, you know, I was just designing it, and then I was working on it in my free time. So anyway, I decided after about 6 weeks of working on this and staying up late and working on it and working on it and working on it that I would go pitch this idea to Google Ventures. And I flew out to Seattle. And they had a Google Ventures company right across the street from this really awesome coffee shop. It wasn't like Starbucks, right? It was like, you know, Seattle awesomeness, perfect hipster coffee shop. And I decided to finish working on my presentation there. Oh, by the way, sidebar. I brought my whole family out. I had my husband and my 9-month-old son at the time, and they were there. And they were just kind of like in the hotel room, like, ooh, what's going on? I'm like, well, okay, I'm just working on my presentation. Just hang out, go to the zoo. Okay, so they were at the zoo. And so I was there, I was just typing away, and I knew I was across the street from this company. And, you know, did you know that, like, Google has these really non-traditional recruiting techniques? Like, for example, they had these billboards that they would put on the side of the road that just had an equation on it. And it would be this, like, massive math equation that, you know, normally most people just drive by it. But the only people that actually would pique their interest would be these computer geeks or math nerds or whatever that would just look up and be like, I feel like solving that equation. And they would solve it, and then they would go to this website and enter in the answer, and it would take them to another website where they would go to another equation that they would have to solve. And they would take them to another website with another equation they had to solve, and then eventually it would take them to another website that said, welcome to Google, you're hired, right? That's what they do. So I knew this about them. So anyway, I'm sitting in the coffee shop right across the street from Google Ventures, and all of a sudden I'm typing on my presentation, and it just starts, like, moving around on my page. I'm just like, I get it. They can kind of, like, see what's going on my computer right now. And, you know, I get a little nervous. I feel like I kind of had to pee. And so I got up. I went to the restroom. I was going to come back. And I came back, and I realized that my zip drive was missing. I'm like, okay, game on. I slapped my laptop closed, ran across the street, banged on the door, and was like, somebody stole my zip drive. I need to give my presentation. I'm ready to go now. And the tiny little Japanese woman in the kimono who opened the door was like, hey, is this a doctor's office? And I was like, I can't believe that they hired actors. This is crazy. So I'm like, all right. And I shoved her out of the way, walked all the way to the back of the room. I'm looking around. There's all these people and these patients. And I'm just like, whoa, this is crazy. And I get to the back, and I'm looking for the boardroom because I want to give my presentation. And I get to the back, and there's just this tiny little office with a woman standing there on the phone talking to the police. And I was like, okay, cool. And she was saying, you know, there's somebody trespassing here. And I'm like, oh, this is getting cool. And then the cop walked in, and he was super cute. And I totally had recognized him from SNL. I knew he was an actor, too. And he just walked in, he had this, like, glint in his eye as he was coming to cuff me. And he grabbed me, and he was walking me out. And I was just flirting with him on the way out because I knew this guy. I'd seen him somewhere. I couldn't remember what the actor was. Something with Justin Timberlake. I'd seen it before. Anyway, so then he tried to take my computer, and I had my laptop with me. I was holding on for dear life, and I knew that this was part of Google, is they was to protect your intellectual property. And I was like, I am not going to fail this test. And so I held on to it as he tried to pull the laptop away from me. I held on to it. I actually slammed myself down on the ground, and he, you know, he tried to pull it away again, and so I bit him, And I knew I was like, man, I probably scored some massive points for that one. They took me to the police station. I'm standing there, and you know, my husband arrived with my son, and he's standing there as well. And he's like, and I was like, wow, I can't believe they got him in on this too. Did they tell him while I was at the zoo, or did they call him? They called him while we were in Austin. Anyhow, I just couldn't figure it out. But then they took me to the hospital to get evaluated, because I knew that they do that with all, like, high-level executives. Just a psychological evaluation prior to the, you know, it's part of the interview, but it's standard. And then I think I did really well, because they released me within a day and said, you know, they were like, a massive manic episode, something like that. And I was released, and I went back to Austin, And then, I don't know, like 2.5 years passed, and kind of still waiting for that second interview. So.
So what was Justine experiencing? What was happening in this story?
Well, you know, we're not allowed to diagnose people who we haven't evaluated,
right,
but
right.
I think she may have intimated that she had bipolar disorder and was in the midst of a manic episode, hadn't slept for days at a time. And it's fascinating when people go through such episodes where their thinking strays as far as it does from reality, which she exhibited in my way of thinking on hearing it was what we call referential thinking. referential thinking sort of means that you have suddenly become the center of the universe, and everything that happens is explainable in terms of you and what you're about to do. So she recognized everyone who she encountered, and everyone was somehow part of this unique interviewing strategy that Google had cooked up, when in fact she was psychotic at the time that she put herself through and her family through this. And I think the other important thing that that story illustrated to me, as did a couple of the others, is the importance that we recognize that people are not islands, that people live often in families or in circles of friends and networks. And when someone in your family becomes ill, it affects everyone in the family.
Does one just wake up one day and have a manic episode? Is there anything that you might see as precursors or hints that somebody's in trouble?
Yeah, I hate to say this, Jamie, but unfortunately there's great variability in that. However, generally speaking, most family members are able to recognize early warning signs that something's going on, as are many people who have the conditions. And yes, if you intervene early and you address it sometimes with medication, sometimes in other ways like reducing person's stress or deciding to postpone a particular trip, then you may be able to head the episode off at the pass. So quite often, seemingly innocent behaviors. I can recall one patient whose mother said, whenever she starts eating Fruit Loops, you know, I know within a week or two there's going to be a problem because she doesn't normally eat Fruit Loops. That's certainly not in any of our diagnostic manuals. So yes, there are early warning signs. And I think the other thing that this leads to a discussion of is what we call psychiatric advance directives. I mean, everyone knows about advance directives for general health care. People don't realize that advanced directives for mental health conditions are available and can be very, very helpful.
Dr. Real, what is an advanced directive?
An advanced directive, in so many words, is a crisis plan that you make ahead of time that enables you to kind of chart the course of how your crisis is going to be handled. It also, in particular, empowers some individual, could be a spouse, could be a parent, could be an adult child, to whom you trust to help you make decisions if you're in a position where you may not be making the best choices.
Okay,
so it's a legal document, preparing a crisis plan, things that you know will work, things that you know will help you to remain calm and cooperative and do what's in your best interest when you have an episode of illness.
What does it mean when this person can process all this and make a story out of it and tell people about her experience? I mean, I would say it's a healthy thing to be able to say, well, you know, hey, look at me.
I think it is very healthy, and that it's particularly that she's able to look back on it and see the humor as well as the pain in the situation. You know, it's interesting. A psychotic episode can be a very painful, very life-altering event. And some people, perhaps protectively, their minds kind of push them way into the recesses. They don't remember much of the detail because it's kind of too painful. So that was an unusual kind of story for someone to be able to tell.
Dr. Real, it occurred to me that you see an increasing number of television shows, jokes, films that use some of mental health symptoms as plots and influences the way that we look at these illnesses or the circumstances of the symptoms.
Most of what I learned early on about behavioral health disorders, I learned from TV and movies. Elizabeth, do you remember the movie Psycho?
Oh, absolutely.
That sound still scares me.
Sure. In the movie Psycho, for those who haven't seen it, real estate secretary Marion Crane skips town with her boss's money instead of going to the bank to deposit it, when a sudden rainstorm forces her to stop for the night at the Bates Motel.
Spoiler alert.
Unbeknownst to Marion, the hotel proprietor, Norman Bates, has an alternate personality, and he kills Marion in the shower with a chef's knife. The murder scene is underscored by the iconic...
Well, one of the greatest barriers to people with mental health challenges getting their lives back, having better quality lives and suffering less, is the stigma that has been around for centuries about people with mental illness. And I think, though, we have come a long way in the past 30 or 40 years in particular to destigmatizing these illnesses, we still have a way to go. But 30 years ago, there were not stars and athletes coming out in public talking about their illness. I know I'm very sensitive to the way mental illnesses are portrayed in the media, in television shows and in movies. And there are still some very disturbing portrayals, particularly those that portray people with mental illness as, you know, by definition, dangerous, you know, the classic psychotic killer. But I think even with that, the portrayals are much more empathic than they used to be. And the psychiatrists you see on TV are much more user-friendly, like the psychiatrist on Code Black.
So, Dr. Real, what are the major disorders?
Well, the major disorders, I would say, would be first, the mood disorders are the most common. And the most common of the mood disorders is what we call major depression, or what sometimes is called clinical depression. Within the subset of mood disorders, there is also what we now call bipolar disorder, what used to be called manic depressive illness, which, though the frequency in the society is maybe 1% or 2%, much less than major depression, which could be as much as 15% or 20%, it's a significant and disabling illness. Another major category of severity of illness is the psychotic disorders, or the schizophrenia spectrum, which is characterized by disorders of people's thinking or their ability to test reality. Beyond that, there's a wide spectrum of anxiety disorders, which includes obsessive compulsive disorder, it includes phobias, includes generalized anxiety disorder, panic disorder, and until recently included post-traumatic stress disorder.
Like Justine, some people who are suffering are not immediately aware of it. But sometimes we know something is not quite right. We'll talk a little bit more about this in our podcast about mechanisms to recognize symptoms in the workplace.
You've been listening to Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. Common Space has been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. I'm Jamie J. So let's go to another story told by a storyteller named Steve, who got what I consider to be a really unique treatment for OCD. Now, Dr. Real, please tell us what OCD stands for.
Stands for obsessive compulsive disorder.
Okay, let's listen to Steve, and then I'm going to come back and ask you to tell us about that.
Do you guys believe in destiny? Yeah, I don't know if I do, but David Foster Wallace, who is an author who people who want to appear intelligent reference often, he once said that nothing ever important happens because we try to engineer it. He says that destiny is always kind of in a trench coat, leaning out of an alley, whispering, psst. But we're usually too busy to hear it because we're on our way to or from something that we tried to engineer. So let's keep that in mind as the story goes on. I want to tell you a joke, an old joke that also might be a metaphor. So there's this executive who works in a skyscraper downtown on the top floor. And he's highly successful, but he has this really weird habit of every time someone walks into his office, he snaps several times. And one day, a curious employee asks him, he says, you know, why do you do that every time someone walks in? And he says, to keep the lions and tigers and bears away. And his employee says, we're in the middle of Center City, Philadelphia. We're on the top floor of a skyscraper. There's no lions and tigers and bears. And he says, see, it's working. I don't know when I began obsessively washing my hands, but I do know that every time I did it, I would count to 15. And just about after every time I got done, I would think to myself, well, there was at least a couple of seconds that I skimped on, so do it again. And I'd go back and I'd do it again, and I'd think the same thing, and I'd walk away. And this time I'd start to think, well, if you don't go back, you're going to get everyone sick. So I'd go back and I'd do it again. And I'd walk away, and this time I'd think, well, now you want to get everyone sick because you're skimping on purpose. And somewhere along the way, I also started to get this thing in my head that I had to end on the number 7 So it'd be like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'd get to 15, and then I'd say 7. But it had to be a good 7. So more often than not, I would wash my hands, and it wouldn't be a good 7, or I'd feel like I hadn't done it enough times. So I'd usually try to end on the number 7, the 7th time washing my hands. Does this make any sense? Yeah, a little bit? Okay, so that's not the only kind of thing that I thought obsessively about and sort of superstitiously tried to fight off, but it's probably the most stereotypical. So it got to the point my sophomore year in college where I couldn't take it anymore. And I started to kind of give up control of this idea, and I went to the counselor at the counseling center at my college. And he gave me a book. And as soon as I gave up control, I started to kind of hear Destiny's whisper. And the book that he gave me was by the number one expert in the world on the treatment of OCD. And this seems to me like destiny. The number one expert in the world for the treatment of OCD resided at the University of Pennsylvania. I emailed her, and she emailed me back. I was a little bit starstruck at first. She told me to come in, so I went in. And I quickly found out, as often happens with insurance, that my insurance didn't cover it. And being the number one center in the world for the treatment of this condition, the cost was prohibitive. However, it just so happened that I was able to enter into a research study and get complete treatment, because at this particular point in time, they were doing a study, and I got free treatment. So I entered this study with a score of 24 out of 40 on the Yale-Brown Obsessive-Compulsive Scale, which meant I was somewhere between moderate to moderately severe. The first thing my therapist told me that I couldn't do for the next 3 months outside of daily showers was wash my hands at all. Now, there's lots of moments where a regular person feels the need to wash their hands. And after going to the bathroom, it was really, really hard for me not to do that. It was really hard for me not to count. But eventually, it got easier. And I was able to do it. When I left the study and I took the Yale-Brown Obsessive-Compulsive Scale test again, I scored an 11, which means that had I gone into the study then, I wouldn't have even been accepted because the symptoms were so unrecognizable. So now, metaphorically speaking, when someone walks into my office, I can greet them and not snap. Thank you.
So, Dr. Real, OCD, you said is obsessive...
compulsive disorder.
What does that mean?
Well, this is a condition in which people suffer greatly and their functioning is often really challenged from either recurrent thoughts that they can't shake, which are known as obsessions, or from compulsions, which are behaviors that they feel just driven to repeat over and over. And often the two are linked together. Hence, in Steve's story, the need to wash his hands a certain number of times and in a certain way and end on a certain number so that terrible things would not happen. That's the obsessive thought. The washing of his hands was the behavior. I think Steve's story illustrates another thing. Sometimes the kind of thinking associated with obsessive compulsive disorder could be called magical thinking. Meaning, like it says, if he did not snap his fingers when somebody, you know, keeps away the lions, tigers, and bears. We all do things like that. Athletes do this all the time. They don't change their socks because the team is on a winning streak. I can remember trying to help the 76ers win games by if I shot a bullseye that, you know, 10 bullseyes in a row, they would win the game. So we're all prone to that kind of thinking that we can influence destiny, influence the world by something that we do.
But what I think I'm hearing from you is the difference between, you know, normal superstition and OCD is where OCD begins to have a negative impact on your life.
Yes, it's the severity of the symptoms and particularly the impact on your functioning in your various roles in your family, at work, in school.
I've seen more than one film in which the clue to somebody's crime is that they have OCD. And somebody says, you know, that's where the problem is. Or, you know, it's a little bit pop psychology. Is it legitimate?
Let's have that conversation, Dr. Real. Let's talk about what is the likelihood of someone suffering from a mental illness becoming a criminal?
I think the likelihood of a person with mental illness becoming a criminal is similar to those who don't. I think that the issue that society wrestles with is the question of violence. And we do know, one, for a fact, that people with severe mental illness are much more likely to be victims of violence than perpetrators of violence. We also do know, and have to be realistic, that there's a very small percentage of people who are both mentally ill and have violent tendencies. And there's endless debate about how best to manage those people and protect their rights as well as protecting the public safety. But it's interesting also, you know, the National Alliance on Mental Illness has for many years been touting the fact that people with mental illness have abilities as well as disabilities. And of course, our department has a small D and a big A in the part that talks about disability services. And it's intriguing, if you look on TV, there's a fair number of protagonists where the people are extremely intelligent and very useful at deductive reasoning and helping to solve crime. So I like the way that people who are a little different than whatever average is are portrayed as having skills and great value.
So let's go to a different story now by Aaron. And Aaron had his own way of getting help. Let's listen to Aaron.
I am an erratic, an erratic daydreamer, or as my therapist likes to call it, a bipolar person with dissociative identity disorder. I know, I didn't get it either. How did we come to this conclusion, right? You like that? How do we come to this conclusion? A long time ago, let's say about 4 months ago. 4 months ago, I'm standing in my kitchen. Standing in my kitchen, I'm looking at my wife, ex-wife now, looking at her, and we're having an argument, really extreme argument. I'm looking at her, I'm like, no, I didn't. I did not do this. I was not doing that. I was not sleeping with this person. I was not out here. I was not driving around here. It got heavy, right? I was not driving around here. I was not looking at this. I was not doing that. And she's looking at me. She's like, Aaron, yeah, you were doing this. You were doing this. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know. You were doing this. Really, really. I'm like, no, really, I wasn't. I was not doing this. I was not doing this at all. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what's going on. And in my mind, I'm thinking, what are you doing, man? What are you doing? Like, you know what she's saying. You know what she's doing. She's telling the truth. You can feel it. You can feel it here. And I don't know if you know anything about mental disorders. Do you know? For this mental disorder, right, when we're talking about it, we're looking at this person. And I'm standing there, and I'm like, yes, 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 this is what my behavior is saying, right? He's saying, do this, do this, do this. But inside, in your heart, in your soul, you're sitting there, you're like, no, what are you doing, man? This is not right. You know what the truth is. Why are you saying this? Why are you doing that? And he's standing there, and I'm standing there. It's me. I'm standing there, and I'm looking at myself, and I'm saying, why? Why are you standing here doing this? Why are you saying this? Why are you lying to this person that apparently pledged her love to you? Standing there in this garden saying, I love you. I love you, and this is where I want to be for the rest of my life. And yet I am standing in this kitchen. I can see the kitchen if you'll close your eyes and imagine with me. In this kitchen, looking at this lime green wall. Yes, we had lime green walls. On my picture that was posted on the wall, you can look down the hallway. If you look back, you can see this bright kind of beige color, which is the living room. And I'm standing there at the glass table, looking at her, saying, no, you cannot go do this. I will not allow you to do this. And inside I'm saying, no, you need to let her go. What are you thinking about? You need to let her go. And at that moment, snap, it clicks. I forget. I black out. I'm thinking, what the heck is going on? The next thing I know, I'm sitting on the stairwell. You walk up to the steps. There's a landing. You walk up to the next of the step. There's a landing, and that's the top of the steps. Well, I was down on that first landing, and I'm sitting there. I'm sitting there with a bottle of Jack in my hand. And I'm sitting there, what in the world is going on? Why did I do this? And I'm crying. I'm sitting there crying with this bottle of Jack in my hand, just looking at it, thinking, this is what it's got to be. This is what I have to do. The whole time, not realizing what was happening in the past, I'm like, what just happened? Why am I here? Why am I sitting here? Where did they go? And by they, I mean my daughter. My daughter was sitting in the living room at the time. Got heavy, right? She was sitting there in the living room, and I'm standing there, and I'm standing in the kitchen as this argument goes on. Snaps. Now I'm sitting on this dining room, on this landing that's the next row up. And I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking to myself, what in the hell happened? And I text my wife, ex-wife. I text her, and I say, where are you? What's going on? And she's like, well, I'm upstairs in the bed. I'm like, why are you upstairs in the bed? She's like, because you took my phone from me, and I had to grab it back from you. And in my head, I'm thinking, wait a minute. No. I didn't do that. I didn't do these things. What are you talking about? But then in my heart, I'm like, wait, something happened. Something really, really serious happened. So I'm sitting there with the Jack and the bottle of Jack in my hand. I'm looking at it. I'm like, I can't do this. What are you doing? So I take another swig. Of course, that's the reasonable answer to do, right? You just take another drink. So I take a swig and I'm like, I can't do this. So I get up. I drive to the hospital. I check in. The lady's very cordial as I'm sitting there at the hospital. What are you here for? I'm in a state of crisis. Okay, can you fill out this paper? Yes, I can do that. Police officer standing behind me. I'm like, why is he standing back there? Didn't realize that he was afraid that I was going to burst out into a psychotic rage and start running around the room. And she's like, okay, will you step over here to the waiting room? I'm like, okay, yes, sure, I'll stand over there. The police officer takes me back after what seems to be hours, but it was probably only 10 minutes because they were probably afraid of everyone's safety. I'm sitting there in the back hallway. I strip down naked to my underwear. Of course, I'm there, and I'm like, this is freezing. I don't know if you know this. They keep hospitals very, very cold. And I'm like, I'm not taking this shit off. I need my underwear because I need that extra layer. So I'm sitting there, and I'm sitting in the hospital bed, and I'm like coming out of this fog, and I'm like, what happened? And that's the moment that I realized in that time, at that moment, I disconnected. And my rage and my body language and my mind got lost in its entirety. That's it.
So, Dr. Real, is it common for someone to have enough presence of mind to know that they need help and drive themselves to the hospital?
I think it is fairly common. Not so much for people in the midst of a psychotic episode, which I don't think that he was. It was hard to tell from his story exactly what was going on. But it was interesting, as with Justine's story, that despite the very distressed state he was in and where he was not thinking as clearly as he could and was really wrestling within his own mind, that he was able to sort of step back from the situation, or presumably step back as he told the story now about what happened in the past, and see what was going on and sort of come to an understanding that the reason the policeman was hovering around was they saw him as a potential time bomb.
You've been listening to Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. Common Space has been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. I'm Jamie J. So this is a story from a student named Craig, and he's talking about a very different phenomenon. And quite frankly, I'd like to know if this is a behavioral health issue. Let's hear from Craig.
Okay.
There's a room full of fists, some red, some clean. The red fists hurt just as much as the thing they connected with. A face is the primary target of those fists. The nurse's office at school is crowded with the same person every other week. It hurts. Parents lay silent, oblivious to their child's whereabouts. It hurts. Sleep some nights to take away the pain. It hurts. Not knowing what to do about it. It hurts. Eventually, the fists start to grow dull, and reality becomes more beautiful. It doesn't hurt. Eventually, the fists begin to recede back and forth, further and further. It doesn't hurt. And while the fists were there eventually, they're gone now. It hurts. Oh, wait. It doesn't hurt. My name is Craig Terry, and this is my story. Being verbally and physically abused is something no child should have to go after. No matter the circumstance, no matter the school, no child should have to pray for a bully to spare him a punch or should I have to sleep some nights to take away the pain? It is a saddening but proven fact that 160,000 kids get bullied each year in schools across the country. That means that there is a kid out there right now being bullied by another one. I should know because for 5 years, my childhood adolescence was dominated by this, bullying. In first grade of 2006 to third grade of 2008, I was bullied. The main kid, he took the mantle of class bully in first grade. He hit on kids for no reason. I never really found out why, but he wasn't a bully to step up to. Now, some may have heard of the cliche stories about the kid who gets tired of his bullies and then steps up to them. But I was the reality. The kid who knew better than to risk his education or the pain for a fight. He started to influence other people to start bullying too. And while sometimes I was the main victim, I never really fought back because I was scared. Fourth grade, nothing changed. The bullying just continued every day from Monday through Friday. Fifth grade hit, it got even worse. There was this new bully named Keyshawn. He was quicker with the hits and taller and stronger. And while I look back on it and realize I shouldn't let them bully me, it doesn't really matter. Because little did I know, 5 years later, my life would change. Because in 10th grade, I was with an internship named Power. Power was a Temple University program that focused on social injustices while getting the youth perspectives on it. And then my internship had offered me a job with a group called Poppin'. Poppin' focused on that while also focusing on video production. I was with people that understood me and had the same interests as me, film and acting. And I know that for a fact that I've changed since elementary school because when I came to this program, I was very quiet. I didn't let anyone talk to me and I didn't talk to anyone else because I thought they would hurt me and I didn't know any better. But then I met one of my leading coordinators and she forced me to talk. And even though I didn't understand then, I understand why now. I was recovering from the insecurities of a neglected child and I didn't know any better. But I know for a fact that I've changed. They have turned me into a more confident person. Every time I talk to them, I get reminded of the memories that we've made. While, thank you. While being bullied had changed me into a quiet person, this summer of 2015 changed me for the better. Instead of me turning into the bully that caused me pain, I instead protect those others who suffer from bullying. Thank you.
So Craig's story starts out by talking about bullying. Is bullying a behavioral health issue?
Well, yes, it is. Certainly, bullying has been shown to be a causal factor in the development of post-traumatic stress disorder and to be a risk factor for young people as regards to suicide. Bullying is a way of being traumatized. And certainly, this individual could have developed some severe mental health challenges as a result of what he experienced at such a vulnerable age. However, I think even more importantly what Craig's story illustrates is the resilience of human beings, particularly kids. That 5 years worth or more of bullying were kind of undone by a couple empathic souls who met him where he was, made him feel respected, made him feel self-value, and he bounced back in a tremendous way.
Is the bully challenged with a behavioral health issue?
The bully may well be. I thought it was very interesting also how Craig, towards the end of his story, said, I could have gone that route. I could have, you know, once I pulled myself together or if I got bigger or if I chose to be in the stereotypical story of the kid who stands up to the bully, that he could have turned into a bully himself. And as we know, people who have been abused often end up being abusers themselves.
You're listening to Common Space at WHYY. I'm your host, Jamie Jay. We've already noted how behavioral health issues can happen to anyone, and often seemingly out of the blue. But what is so amazing is how many people have managed to thrive in their lives despite them. A Beautiful Mind is a 2001 American film based on the life of John Nash, a Nobel laureate in economics. The film was inspired by a book of the same name by Sylvia Nasar. Now, early in the film, Nash begins to develop paranoid schizophrenia and endures delusional episodes while painfully watching the loss and burden his condition brings on his family and friends.
Just have to talk quietly. They may be listening. There may be microphones. I'm going to tell you everything now. Because you have to help me get out of here. Alicia, I've been doing top secret work for the government. They're keeping me here to try to stop me from doing my work.
Hey, Jamie, this reminds me of a conversation I had about 3 years ago at a conference on behavioral health when I spoke with Dr. Frederick Fries. He's one of the most respected authorities on schizophrenia in the country, and he told me his story.
At one point, I was actually declared to be insane, an insane person, and committed and told I'd spend the rest of my life in the hospital, but I got out. There were no overt symptoms until I came down with a disorder. I mean, I'd been selected for a national scholarship by the Navy and then selected again to go in the Marine Corps. I'd served 4 years, just been promoted to captain when I developed this delusional system concerning the Vietnam War. I mean, here I was working 24/7 during the Vietnam War, guarding these atomic weapons, and then they locked me away and called me crazy. I was absolutely sure they were making a mistake. In my mind, and that's the way it works with schizophrenia, delusions. As I often say, if the guy with the delusion knows it's a delusion, then it's not a delusion. So when you have this, you can't tell yourself that there's really something wrong with you. So I spent quite some time thinking that really there's nothing wrong with me. But after a number of hospitalizations, particularly when I was put away as insane, I thought, yeah, it's probably, maybe there's something wrong here. Not with me, but something wrong somewhere. 50 years ago, the answer to somebody being seriously mentally ill was to put them away forever, essentially. Now 95 of those of us who were or would have been in those old state hospitals are out. Now, not all of us are doing as well as myself or some others. I mean, there are too many homeless in the streets or in jail. There are 400,000 seriously mentally ill in jail, which we really need to do something about. But the big thing that I feel is it's important for me to interact with the professional communities, the psychiatrists, the psychologists, the research communities, the Veterans Administration, and advocacy groups such as NAMI and the Mental Health Association, et cetera, and be a living example. I can function even though I have this disorder. And there are an awful lot of people like me. Most of them will not be open about having had these psychotic breaks. Now, in the old days, I didn't want to be lobotomized. I didn't want forced electroshock therapy and the terrible things that were done in the early 20th century. But for the most part, that's behind us. I'm not over it. I still have episodes, and the mind works funny ways, but I'm able to catch it with the medication and that sort of thing.
Dr. Frederick Fries is a psychologist with over 40 years of experience in public mental health. He's a professor of psychiatry at Northern Ohio Medical University.
So, Dr. Real, our last storyteller, Jeff, talked about being a young person, a child, who has been transplanted into an environment very different from anything else he's ever experienced, where he is very different. He looks different from everyone around him. And he talks about this traumatic experience he had in school. Let's listen to Jeff.
I'm very fortunate in that I have excellent parents. I have a wonderful mother, I have a wonderful father, and my father's parenting philosophy can be distilled to one fact, one approach, which is my children will not go to public school. He grew up in the South Side of Chicago. He went to terrible public schools. He made the tough decision to move my family from that environment to very isolated Illinois, farm country, very insular community. I would call it a rural community, but the word rural is grotesque and disgusting. Even I, with my perfect diction, struggle with the word rural. So we moved to this isolated farm community. Marengo is the name of it. And my father wanted us to go to functionally a parochial school. It was a church school. He wanted us to be able to play outside. So we lived in this very isolated area. We were able to play outside. And we were able to go to this school. It was dreadful. Dreadful place. Dreadful place. A very insular community, meaning that a group of farmer families had founded it a little over a century prior, and no one else had moved in or out until we arrived. They had been largely Scandinavian farmers, so we stuck out immediately. We did not fit in, and they made it very clear to me that I did not fit in very immediately. I also had a terrible stutter and a lisp. I had yet to perfect my impeccable diction. My head was about the same size that it is now on a much smaller body. School was tough. Kindergarten was tough. It was very, very tough. I felt threatened all the time. And like many people who feel threatened, I decided to fortify my position. Since I was a small child, I didn't have a lot available to me, but I used what was available, and that was my desk. I got under it. And you couldn't get me out. Anytime there was a problem, which was often, I would get under that desk. Jeffrey. Yes. Can you draw a circle? Yes. Long pause. They didn't ask me if I would draw a circle. They asked me if I could draw a circle. I understood language, and it infuriated them. They started yelling and screaming. Under the desk I went. They tried to pull me out. They tried to intimidate me out. They couldn't do it. Made a big scene. Called my parents. Calling the administrators. Everybody in the school is talking about this crazy kid with a huge head and a lisp who won't come out from under his desk. Thankfully, there were two kindergarten teachers. I was in Miss Carrillo's class, and there was another kindergarten teacher. His name was John Fleener. He heard about this commotion, about this child under the desk, and he came to find out more. And he came over, and he said, Jeffrey, what are you doing under this desk? And I explained my position to him. And he said, do you want to come over and be in my class across the hall? I said, no. I want to go home. And he said, well, we can't send you home, but you're welcome to stay under your desk all day in my class if you want. And I said, okay. So I transferred. He moved me to his class. He had no problem with me staying underneath the desk. He would put the assignments to be completed on top of the desk. I would reach up. I would complete them. They were simple things, like using one's hand as a stencil to make a turkey. It's kindergarten. It's not complicated stuff, but it's important stuff. So I would reach up, and I would complete the assignment. I would put it back on top of my desk. He never made a big deal out of it. He's like, yeah, he's a little weird. He's got a lisp. Let him stay under the desk all day. I don't care. I care about the results. And I was usually right. I was very good at spelling. I was very good at hand turkeys. I was excelling in kindergarten. And this man saved my education. Because everyone else in that school was prepared to just leave me under there and write me off as some sort of degenerate or weirdo or someone that had deep-seated emotional problems, as opposed to a small child in an aggressive community of people who don't want him there, who's just trying to feel safe far from home. John Fleener ended up being my godfather. John Fleener ended up saving my life in ways that I don't think he probably still doesn't even appreciate how much he's done for me. And if any of you find yourselves in a comparable situation, who is this weirdo? Take a little time, be a little patient with them. You never know what might happen. Could end up like this guy. I turned out all right. Thank you.
What is happening in that story? What's happening to Jeff?
I think Jeff was doing the best that he could as a small child under the circumstances of being scared to death and afraid that if he showed his head, it might be cut off. I'll tell you what I thought this story in particular illustrated, as well as resilience and the capacity for resilience, that sometimes it only takes one person, the teacher who invited him into his classroom and said, you can stay under your desk as long as you want. It only takes one person to make a difference and turn things around. So again, this theme of treating people kids, homeless people, psychotic people, people with substance use disorders with dignity and respect often makes all the difference in helping them recover.
I know that there's a confidentiality that you have to deal with as a physician, but can you tell us, you know, a profound experience that you had that made this work really meaningful for you?
I think I could. I will try and tell you a short version of this. You know, we haven't talked about it on this show. You might talk about it on another show, which is the whole concept of recovery, meaning that people with these challenges can improve or can have very meaningful, productive, quality lives despite the presence of a mental illness or a substance use disorder. And that people have great potential, and you have to be careful because in the old days, somebody developed an illness like schizophrenia. You know, some doctors would essentially say to families, you know, forget about it. His life is over. Years ago, I met a young man who, to all intents and purposes, that could have been what I concluded. He could not keep a job because of the severity of his psychosis. He was living home with his family, and it did not seem like his future held much for him. And then over time, what I discovered was he wanted to get a job. So first he got a part-time job helping out a guy, the old-fashioned TV repairman, lugging TVs in and out. And then before long, that turned into he got a full-time job working in a quarry somewhere. And he told me he was going to get a full-time job, and I'm thinking, yeah, right, until he gets a full-time job. And then no longer did he had the full-time job. He started talking about he was going to get a house. And I'm thinking, right, he's going to get a house, until he came in and told me about how he had bought a house and moved out from his parents. On and on to getting a car. And once he walks in my office and tells me that he's got a girlfriend 20 years after we met, I'm going to say, you know, our work is done. But I never would have believed that possible. And what has impressed me profoundly over time, again, is the resilience of people and the depth of the human spirit and how people can overcome all sorts of odds and achieve all sorts of things that you didn't think imaginable.
What can we do if we suspect that someone we love is undiagnosed but struggling with something?
You can talk to them and listen empathically and be there for them and try to help them find a way to accept help.
What if they don't want to accept help, but they are clearly struggling?
Well, you might want to seek some counseling of your own. Nowadays, there are people who do what's known as family consultation, and they will help you to strategize differently. You also don't need to give up, because some people accept these things at different paces. But people do recognize that you're there and that you care, though they may never seem to listen to what you're suggesting.
You've heard the stories. Is there something that we haven't asked you simply because we don't know to ask?
Perhaps, and I think it's probably on the tip of all of our brains. What you have presented me and your audience with is these wonderful stories from first-person arts. And what essentially this is people telling about their lived experience. And we have learned in our field that one of the greatest assets that we have are the people we have who have lived experience, who have recovered sufficiently to where they can use their lived experience and their own experience of recovery to help others along the way. And I think if there's anything that's revolutionary or about time in what we do in the behavioral health field, it has been the recognition of the importance of certified peer specialists and people with lived experience in helping their brothers and sisters.
So we are storytellers or heroes.
Your storytellers are heroes to me.
You've been listening to Common Space. This is Jamie J., your host. And we've been talking today to
Dr. Larry Reel,
Chief Medical Officer of the City of Philadelphia Department of Behavioral Health and Intellectual Disability Services, and the executive sponsor for Mental Health First Aid. Dr. Reel, thank you so much for your time. We so appreciate you here at Common Space.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. It's been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. Common Space includes this broadcast, live events, and two additional podcasts available online. Common Space airs on WHYY, the last Sunday of each month. Remember to tune in. It's also available anytime online at acommonspace.org, where you'll also find two monthly podcasts that dive deeper into the topics presented here, show transcripts, live event schedules, and ways to share your stories with us.
Common Space is produced by Mike Villers. The Common Space team includes Shridevi Shripathi, Dan Goshevsky, Becca Jennings, Jen Cleary, and Neil Barton. Our studio engineers were Al Banks and Adam Staniszewski. Jamie Brunson is the host and co-writer. And I'm Elizabeth Perez Luna, executive producer and lead writer.
One more thing, on a personal note. Todd Marone was a storyteller for First Person Arts for a long time. During the 2011 Christmas season, Todd took his own life. It was a blow to the First Person Arts family. We asked ourselves, did we miss the signs? Could we have done something to help? Todd's death was a wake-up call for us. This show is dedicated to him. Rest in peace, Todd.